My name is Karen Collins, and I currently work at the National Council of Churches in New York City, and I've been working there since 1985, working in child advocacy the majority of the time. Right now I'm going to be focusing more on child health issues, but my focus has always been children. I am an early childhood educator. I did a master's degree at Bank Street in early childhood education, and then I taught young children, 3 to 5 year olds, for about 8 years. And after that I worked for a peace and justice organization named Clergy and Laity Concern, but my concern has always been for young children in particular. And so in talking today, I'm going to focus a lot on young children, but I want to also broaden the discussion to talk about older children as well. Come on in. Hi. Let's see. Why don't we just go around the room and just say your name and where you're from, so that we at least have a sense of who we are. And why don't we start over here?
Mary Quinnell, Redmond, Washington.
And say it loud enough so everybody can hear.
Mary Quinnell, Redmond, Washington.
Donna McLeod, Charlotte, North Carolina.
Annette Schlinger, Mankato, Minnesota.
Carol Knutson, Mount Vernon, Washington.
Bob Hirataka, Redmond, Washington.
Wendy Hirataka, Redmond, Washington.
Jennifer Morales, Bryan, Texas.
Jenny Myers, Chicago, Illinois.
Jim Lundy, Portland, Oregon.
Julie Bucknett, Sun Valley, Idaho.
Catherine Weaver, Cheyenne, Wyoming.
Dorothy Ritter, Seattle Ritter, Washington.
Pat Garnsey, Tacoma,
Washington.
Darlene Dobson, Eugene, Oregon.
Ruby Harris, Tacoma, Washington.
Disley English, Holden Ridge.
Holden Ridge.
My, you came a long distance.
Montrose staff right now.
Great. How many of you are involved at all in education? Either. Great. And how many of you are involved in preschool education, young children? And elementary education? Good. Are there others of you, maybe those same people, and also others who are involved in Sunday school or any kind of church education? Right. And how many of you also have children in your homes right now? And others who have raised children who are no longer at home? Yes. Good. Oh, and I'm in all those categories as well, I think. Good. You've probably seen my kids around. I have a 1.5 year old and a 3.5 year old that are here at the village with my husband and I. Hi, welcome. Sit down. I want to begin by what's probably a familiar quote to many of you. From Proverbs 22:6, train children in the right way, and when old, they will not stray. I think this is perhaps taken more seriously by some denominations than others, but there certainly is an enormous amount of reality in that, and I think that's probably why we're all here, because we know the impact that environment and adults have on young children and children as they are growing up, so that we need to take seriously what kind of environment they're in and what kind of experiences they have, because that is going to be the major determinant in what kind of people they become as they grow up and in our society as a whole. I wanted to read you just a couple of little vignettes out of this book, which, as I mentioned before some of you came in, is a resource for early childhood educators from the National Association for the Education of Young Children, but which I believe is extremely useful by other people as well. I mean, I would love, for example, to see some of the national churches in this country to begin to pick this up as a tool for modeling Sunday school curricula. And I think it's also a tool that parents of young children can use, because it doesn't really matter whether you're talking about an environment in a classroom or your home, that many of the concepts remain the same. But very early on, children begin to exhibit some of the prejudices and earlier on pre-prejudice prejudices that are reflected in our society as a whole. And it's really quite staggering, I think, to see how early those things begin to be put in place. And in understanding how early they begin to be put in place, we better understand how important it is to address these issues early on. So let me just read a couple of stories here. These are stories taken from classrooms, from actual classrooms in California on which this book was based. Oh, I turned 40 this year, so I can't see anymore. Okay. Two four-year-old friends, one black, one white, are chattering. Mike says, "I'm going to get new pants." Doug says, "What color?" Mike, "Blue." Doug, "What about brown?" Mike, "I don't like brown." Doug, "Oh, then you don't like me." Mike looks surprised. "Yes, I do." At this point, the teacher steps in. "There's something important I want to help you two to figure out. Doug, why do you think Mike doesn't like you?" And Doug says, "I'm brown. He said he doesn't like brown." The teacher, "Mike, Doug thought when you said you didn't like brown, you meant you didn't like his brown skin either. Is that what you meant?" Mike, "No, I don't like brown pants. I like brown Doug." The teacher says, "Well, Doug, is that okay?" Doug nods his head yes, and the two go off together. Second story. "Craig's eyes go like this," says four-year-old Ruth as she pulls her eyes up. "They look funny." Her teacher replies, "Craig's eyes aren't funny. They have a different shape than yours. Craig's eyes are the same shape as his family's eyes, just as your eyes are shaped like your family's. Your eye shape is fine, and Craig's eye shape is fine too. Both of your eye shapes are good for seeing. It is okay to ask questions about how people look, but it is not okay to say that they look funny. That hurts their feelings." Third story. A 2.5-year-old Asian child refuses to hold the hand of a black classmate. "It's dirty," he insists. This is 2.5-year-old child. This is a true story. "It's dirty," he insists. At home, after bathing, he tells his mother, "Now my hair is white because it's clean." And that was an Asian child who said that. Fourth story. Two 5-year-old white boys are playing in the sandbox. A Vietnamese boy asks to join them. "Nah, nah, you can't play with us, you Chinese," they chorus, pulling their eyes into a slant. What do you think? What do you think when you hear those stories? Does it remind you of things that you've heard yourselves? Are you surprised that it's happening that young? Is that what you see all the time? How do you respond?
In a Head Start class, and there's a lot of minority. And so some of these things I hear, for the most part, the kids, most of their conversation focuses on like color of skin. Like the assistant I had is black, and one little girl went home and told her mommy she had a brown teacher and a peach teacher. So most of it's like that, but I've heard some of those kind of things too with the kids. And they're 4 and 5, so.
Our daughter's heard some of it when she goes to a Lutheran school. And it sort of shocked me. But then, in a way, I think it's more the kids pick on each other. This is something they could pick on her for. It wasn't because, but maybe I'm naive. I don't know if the kids are really prejudiced or something they could pick out or pick on her. If they pick on anything.
Now, one of those was a 2.5-year-old, right? Where would they get that message at 2.5? The parent went directly. Would it come from another child more so than a parent?
I don't know.
I think they could pick it up from parents too. I mean, it's amazing. I've taught with 2-year-olds, and they really, I mean, they pick up a lot from cues from you. They really can pick up. One little girl in the class, she was white. And there were maybe 2 white kids in the class, and she was pointing around at the table saying, "I can be your friend and your friend, but that's all, because my daddy says I can't play with no black kids." And I said, "Well, you know, what about Karanda? Isn't she your friend?" Because they were like best friends. And she said, "Yes." And I said, "Well, do you like Mrs. Cooper?" And she said, "Yes." I said, "Well, they're black." And she just looked, oh, you know, she was just it was just something she said because her dad said it, but she didn't really realize that she was, I mean, at that point, I don't think she realized it, because when I mentioned they were black, she looked kind of confused.
That was the parent.
Well, her dad said that she couldn't play with any black kids. Yeah, so she was repeating that, but she was starting to point and say, you can't be my friend. And at 4 and 5, you know, kids cry when they say, you know, I'm not your friend.
And what you did was actually very important, which is a lot of what we're going, more of what we're talking about, to be at, to step in to a situation and clarify. Because a lot of what children are trying to do, I mean, why don't we move a little bit to some child development theory? Because I think it's, very simply, but I think it's important at this point. Because children are struggling with this. I mean, they're trying to figure out their world. I mean, if you when you watch young children, you see them experimenting and listening and touching and doing everything to try and understand their world. They understand their world as young children with their bodies by how things feel. They understand it from their exposure, their social environments. What kinds of things they see, what kinds of things they experience, what kinds of things they hear, what kinds of things they see. Children are sponges. They get it everywhere. I mean, I sometimes think that, you know, it's you wonder where children get things, but they pick up everything. I mean, they are, I never fail to be amazed as an early childhood educator and a parent of young children how smart our young children are and how perceptive they are. And it only takes once. Mm-hmm. You know, they only have to see or hear something once. And it's part of their schema in understanding their world. And then the other thing that is into play is where they are developmentally. I mean, how old they are. But by the age of two, children are learning the appropriate gender labels. For example, they're trying to figure out, I'm a boy, you're a girl. They're using those names. Mommy's a girl, daddy's a boy. Figuring out in those kinds of ways. But they're also learning color names. And it's at this point that they begin to be aware of sex, of racial differences and ethnic differences, along with that understanding of color difference. My child at 1 and a half, I don't think really is particularly aware of racial ethnic differences. He doesn't see them, but my daughter at 3 and a half does. And it's a developmental stage that she has moved into and is moving through that Daniel hasn't yet moved to. By 3 years of age, children show signs of being influenced by the social norms and biases around them. So by the time most children are in nursery school or in preschool education or in child care programs, if they're not already in infant and toddler programs, they are being strongly influenced by what they hear around them, by the way the teachers interact, by what their parents tell them, by the way the parents and teachers interact, by the way children interact, by the way the children interact with all those adults. And all that stuff is grist for the mill. And all that stuff is they are using to build their understanding of the world. Because up to this point, they don't know. I mean, that's not something which they are born with. I mean, they are putting the pieces together to construct the fabric, which is then going to be their understanding of the world. And it's also at this point where things are not set in stone yet, but they begin to develop pre-prejudicial attitudes is what it's called in early childhood education. But, you know, it's early discomfort with differences, early fear of differences, early sense of being a little better than somebody else. And that all of that is not yet clearly enough formulated to be the basis for drawing conclusions or making opinions as prejudices are. I mean, real prejudices are those feelings and understandings on which we make decisions or upon which we make judgments that are not rational, because they aren't really based on information. They're based on a set of feelings or a set of stereotypes that are not necessarily true to that situation. And by the time children are 3 to 5, they're trying to figure out essentially what attributes of their own selfhood and what things are staying. So for example, they would be really trying to figure out, well, you know, what am I? You know, am I an Indian? I look pretty red today. You know, my skin is very ruddy. Or am I Asian? Or who am I? Or what? And will I look different when I take a bath? Will my skin color change? And will it look this way when I grow up? When I look when I'm a mommy, will it look like this? Or when I'm... And so they're trying to figure all that out. I mean, what kind of permanency is in it? I saw somebody who had lots of freckles. Will I have lots of freckles when I get to be 5? None of that is understood yet. So that's all this is going on, all this is building. And by the time children are 4 or 5 years of age, they are using behavior which is generally appropriate, defined as appropriate by the prevailing social norms. So if they are living in an environment which is racist, children will be behaving in racist ways by the time they are 4 or 5 in their play with other children. If they are growing up in a sexist atmosphere, the same thing will be true. And we see this in the classrooms. You know, this is where you sort of hear the appalling kinds of things that go on. You say, you know. And it's interesting that sometimes the attitudes that children have are not necessarily true to their own experience. And I don't have a personal example of one related to race, but rather related to gender, where a friend of mine is a senior partner in a law firm. He's a very accomplished lawyer in Washington, D.C. Her husband is also, her husband unfortunately is deceased, but at the time this story happened, her husband was also a lawyer, but a very sort of, you know, sort of a low-key guy. He was a lawyer for a nursing home and worked, you know, straight 9 to 5 hours, did all the cooking, took most of the child care. And one day we were out walking together, and Caitlin, who was about 4 at the time, says, "Mommy, stay at home and do the cooking, and Daddy's go to work." And Karen looked at her and said, "You're kidding. Where did you get that?" Because it was completely contrary to Caitlin's experience. And yet, she had picked up enough of it in the environment around her and from the books and the posters and the pictures and the conversation and everything else, that her understanding of what was the norm for mommies and daddies was completely contrary to her own experience. So we have to be very, very aware of what is going on in the lives of young children as they are developing. And very aware of the norms of what's going on in our environment around us, because that may be affecting our children in ways that we don't feel particularly good about. Now, I think it's important to say that at the same time that there are a lot of values in our society that we may not be particularly happy about. And I imagine this group here would share a lot of my feelings that I'm not at all happy with the racism, the sexism, the kind of class prejudice, the emphasis on capitalism and consumerism, and a lot of things in our society. The same time that we need to be aware of all those things, the really hopeful thing is that at the same time, children are very, very open to hearing the opposite, just as they will absorb all the biases that we don't like. They are also ready and willing to think about the other side of it, the that which is non-racist, non-sexist, etc., etc., etc. I'm doing more talking than I feel comfortable doing. Why don't we get some? What are some other people's thoughts on any of this?
One of my reactions to the first stories that you read was when the teacher, of course, had the right things to say. You know, I'm always hoping I'm saying the right things at the right time, knowing this is the moment and everyone's listening to me. And she said something like, you know, eyes are for seeing and eyes of any shape are fine. I don't remember the exact words. These eyes are fine, these eyes are fine. And sometimes I wonder, is fine good enough? And I spend some time stressing how different people, how different is okay, and skin differences are it's hard for me to know where, what to, if making, I guess the main thing for me is it okay to be just fine and eyes are utilitarian, skin keeps our bodies together, and you're talking to a 3-year-old, you know, it holds all your insides in, and that's what's important. But is that good enough when your friend tells you you look funny? Do I go the extreme and say, you know, my natural reaction is that your eyes are beautiful, and when talking to a class, and all the different kinds of people we have, I don't think fine is good enough is what my feeling is.
How do other people feel about that?
I think one thing is children are very perceptive. And if you go too far, immediately they know there's something wrong because you're trying too hard to make it right. And so we have to be careful not to put our prejudices or lack of prejudice, you know, stress it too hard on children. Because then if you go into this thing about how beautiful slanted eyes are and everything, they're going to say, it's like trying to convince a kid to eat spinach. You know, something is wrong with this because they're trying too hard to tell me it's good. And so then if you go into this big tirade about how beautiful slanted eyes are, round eyes are, brown skin is so wonderful and it's such a rich color and all this, they're going to think, there is something wrong because she's trying too hard to convince me. And so I think that if we can be honest in our perception, not so much as trying to do the right thing, but being, if we think right, be honest in our perception.
If we think right.
Then that's a lot better than trying to really convince somebody. And then they'll watch how you do. All right, if brown skin is fine, how come you ought to give her cookie black and she's brown? You know, something like that.
But I think your point is well taken at the same time. We have to keep both things in mind. It's probably not an either or, but I think you're right. I mean, the bottom line when we're working with young children is that their own self-identity and self-concept is the very best it can possibly be, provided it's not at the expense of anybody else. I remember a friend of mine was once saying, as an African-American man who was raised by his grandparents, and I remember his grandfather told him, nobody is better than you. I remember Jim saying, nobody's better than me. And then his grandfather said, but you're not better than anybody else either. And I think that, you know, that's really kind of the bottom line, you know, that we have to, that the children's identity, we have to affirm their identity and their own self-concept and support that in every way possible, but also support the self-concept and identity of everyone else. You are wonderful and important, and so is everybody else. You are special and unique, and everybody else is special and unique in their way as well. But it's something that I think we need to be very aware of. The other thing I think in confronting differences, which is important, is that perhaps in the example that you raised earlier in the Head Start program where the father had said, you can't play with any black children. When we point out an injustice which is happening or something which we don't like, we can actually be supporting the children's own development of their capacity to think critically about situations, to find solutions, new solutions to situations, to ask why if they're not sure that that's right. The capacity to think critically is one which I think we as adults need to take very seriously as a centerpiece of learning. And working with young children is absolutely the place to begin. Child developmentalists will tell us that 40% of what a child ever knows, 40% of what a person ever knows, they know by the time they're 4 years old, and 80% of what a person ever knows, they know by the time they're 8. That's a lot of learning, and really points up the importance of the experience that young children have. Any other thoughts?
I think sometimes it's just nice to sit there and listen. You know, sometimes you have to come in because the kids in the group will kind of put in their own thoughts. One time I had a girl in my class that had a black father and a white mother, and the kids were talking about what colors their babies at home were, and they were all asking, what color's your baby, what color, and they were just having this little discussion about it, and it wasn't really harmless, they were just discussing it. They were just interested, and they were asking, you know, one of the black girls, you know, was her baby black or was her baby white, you know, and they asked the little girls, they were just wanting to know. And so it's interesting just to listen sometimes, to see what they say. It's not always, you don't always need to come in. They discuss the differences on their own.
What about, I think, the other reason it's important not to just tray it down completely is that differences are a reality. And children know that things are different. They know that our eye color is different. They know that our hair textures are different. They know that our skin colors are different. They know that our cultures are different. And to not really acknowledge those differences, on the one hand, people will argue is helping those children because it's a sense of being kind of colorblind, you know, that there are no differences, we're all the same. Yet in reality, children know that there are differences. And they're trying to sort it all out. And if we don't help them then they're going to have to sort it out on their own. And they need our support in figuring it out because they don't have all the answers. They don't have all the pieces. So they need our support. The other reality is that we live in a racist society. I mean, if we're talking about racial ethnic differences, we live in a racist society. And we don't need to spell out all the economic and political implications of that with young children because they don't have the background of experience to understand what that's all about. But they do begin to understand that they will understand by the time they're 4 or 5 year old if they are in, pretending what kind of an environment they are, but most children begin to understand that racial ethnic differences can be a cause for other kinds of things, for differences in power relationships, for differences in how people are thought about, how much money they have, the kind of for young children it isn't necessarily all spelled out, but they intuit these things. They can pick up these things from the way people interact with each other, how people are treated, how they treat one another. And so it's important for us to affirm that racial ethnic differences are real, and that the economic power and political power and the cultural importance that is afforded to different racial and ethnic groups is also real. We have to help them to understand that, but then to demythologize the pieces of it that we don't like, to help them understand the reality of differences, but then to help them to understand that oppression of any people on the basis of racial or ethnic background is wrong. And then to help them to understand how the racist aspects of our society is also wrong. How about some more reactions? Any other thoughts that are going through people's minds?
It seems to me that prejudice sometimes is based on this old feeling that we have in our culture that there's a lack, that there's not room for lots of different ideas.
Uh-huh.
People, that being able to emphasize love and the fact that love encompasses all should kind of open doors for children to be able to.
Can you think of a place in particular where you've heard that talked about, that there isn't room for all the differences, that there, I mean, I suppose it's sort of the melting pot theory or the, but we all have to be the same.
Well, I don't know exactly, even older children, minor teenagers. Mm-hmm. they too have to be reminded continually that because somebody doesn't have maybe the perfect body or the perfect wardrobe, that they're not okay, as though we all have to be of the same mold. I just think it has to be sort of reinforced on all levels, not just race, but at all levels.
It's interesting because an example of that just happened in New York State, actually. The head of the Department of Education in New York State set up a task force and asked them to do work on developing a new social studies curriculum for the state of New York. And the task force came back with a report which is basically a kind of anti-bias approach to curriculum development. That is one which really rewrites curricula to affirm in new ways the part in history, for example, of racial ethnic minorities that are not given that kind of affirmation in our history as the way they are often written today. And the single point that came up over and over and over again in the kind of discussion in the letters to the editor and the op-ed pieces and, you know, back and forth and back and forth was this whole question of, but, you know, we have a national identity. What will happen to our national identity if we allow for all this difference? It's a very real concern for many, many people that talking about differences will undermine our sense of wholeness as a country. Whereas for other people, it's more an opportunity to enhance what that understanding of our country is. But it may or may not be comfortable with that kind of approach. I'd like to just stop for a minute because I've been doing too much talking. And I'd like to ask each of you to think of a time when you either experienced racism yourself or you witnessed racism in your life. And then to think about what you did about it. And to think about how you felt about what you did about it. If you can't think of a situation of racism, I think we all can. But if you absolutely blank out on that, to think of some other prejudice, some other kind of exhibition of prejudice that either you experienced yourself or that you witnessed. It might be vis-a-vis a child or it might be vis-a-vis adults. And then I'd like you to just pair off with the person next to you and each person just talk about that experience for about 3 minutes. And then the other person will have an opportunity to talk about it. So we have a chance to focus our own thinking a little bit about the racism or the prejudice that we experience in our own lives. Does that make sense to people? Mm-hmm. Are people comfortable with that? Okay. Any of the experience?
I have one. I still need help on. This happened a long time ago, but I was going to a story time. At the time, I just had two daughters. And my younger daughter is Korean-American. And we went to the story time. There's a little girl there, a little Caucasian girl, and she'd probably never seen anybody that was Asian before. And she said, you know, in her loud little three-year-old voice, something like, why is that little girl by so little? And my main concern was that my older daughter, my younger daughter's sister, was listening, and this was impacting her. We went 4 weeks in a row, and every time this little girl, I'd answer her patiently and say, you know, because, as best I could, and every time, and finally after a month, I stopped going, I wanted to take that little girl and leave my child alone, don't you understand? So sometimes I get frustrated in dealing, she was just a very busy, vocal, you know, really verbally very smart little girl, and I wanted to crack her.
But you know, one of the things that help, if you ask them, well, I talked to you last week, why are her eyes so little? And she'll probably just tell you the same answer you gave her. Because her parents have eyes like that, blah, 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 right. Blah, blah. And then you can say, well, that's why her eyes are little. But if you keep explaining, and I notice with children, it's very good after you've told them once or twice, they'll say, well, you tell me why.
Right.
And they'll just turn right around and tell you whatever you've told them before.
That's good. I didn't really want to keep focusing on it and hearing it because it made it seem like such a big deal to the whole group. It's like this was the focus of story time somehow. And that would have probably done it. That wasn't really prejudice. She's just at that same, different kind of stage of identifying.
But it sounds like in that situation, you were the only person who was trying to help that child understand.
Yes, that's the other person I wanted to crack was, you know, mother was sitting right there.
And
you probably know what he's saying either.
This was a mother's group?
No, just a story time and you all sit around and try and, you know.
Was there a teacher or a person leading it?
Who didn't.
I mean, that could have been another person you could have probably wanted to have physical contact.
But
all those people should have been responsible with you. I mean, you shouldn't have had to take all that responsibility yourself. And I guess what would have been important is to somehow figure out how you could have gotten support for yourself in figuring that out. Because it could have been that, I mean, there's some wonderful books out now, and I can't rattle off titles for you, but which have Asian children as characters in the stories. And it might have been very appropriate for the teacher to read one of those stories, where an Asian child has a primary role in the story, and it's a role which is affirming and not sort of the quiet, passive child, but, you know, it's an affirming leadership kind of role. And it would have been a very appropriate thing. And you might or might not have had to have also talked specifically about her own comments, but it may have been that wasn't doing the trick. So that to try and talk and to influence that child's thinking in other ways, by pictures on the wall, by other stories, by songs which included everyone, by, you know, the pictures they might have done. And sometimes story times are not story times in and of themselves, but particularly for young children, can involve other kinds of activities which complement the story. And it might have been, I think it probably would have been, that a more creative, I shouldn't say this, but a more creative storyteller could have incorporated some of those other experiences if she or he would have been willing to try and do that. Any other comments that people have, thoughts?
My daughter will be a senior in high school next year, and we live in Pasadena, California. And the public schools are 40% Hispanic, 40%, no, this is generalized, 40% Afro-American and 20% white or Caucasian, which takes in lots of others, Armenians and others too. But my daughter in middle school had lots of friends, lots of black friends, lots of Asian friends, and lots of Mexican or Hispanic friends, and lots of white friends. She's a very social girl and has lots of friends. Well, the black friends that she had in middle school that she has now in high school have turned on her because she's white. And it's kind of like everything is reversing. And my comment to her was, well, that sounds fair. It was the other way around for 200 years. And we maybe have to be open to, I said, they're obviously getting some feedback or some feelings or pressures from their parents, and anger from their parents maybe, because they were real good friends when they were in middle school. Mm-hmm. And then 2 years later in high school, the friendships are just kind of turning. And I don't think that my daughter has caused it. I mean, I'm sure she hasn't, because she just has lots of different friends, and just because she likes the people, not because of what their race is. And it's really hard. She's going to go to a seminar or a camp, it's called, in August when we get home. It's called Brotherhood Sisterhood Camp, and it's a camp to promote openness. And it's run by the National Conference for Christians and Jews. But they're going to talk about racial differences, and all different races and religious groups go to this camp. And it's really a tough experience, I've heard. But it really helps them get to know themselves as well as getting to know other people from where they're coming from. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's not easy. I mean, Pasadena has really gotten tense. So it's just really tense. So many gangs and drugs and in other cities too. But it's really hard in the high schools to hang in there and be open to real violence on the in the kids.
And I think that speaks to the fact, you know, that although, you know, we've been focusing on young children, that it's not an issue that we ever stop supporting our young people, our children, in understanding. And that, yeah, and I was going to raise that really, I mean, the racism in our country is so systemic and so endemic that it's something that we always, or, you know, it's always a lifelong commitment that each of us needs to make, I think, to ourselves and to our society, to our community, that we are going to ourselves continually work on our own racism and confronting our own racism. Because for those of us who are white, we live in a racist society, and we have certain privileges by virtue of being European American, white, that other racial ethnic groups don't have. That doesn't mean that there aren't prejudices in other, you know, in other, among racial ethnic groups also, but there aren't the power, there isn't the power piece, that piece that European Americans have more power vis-a-vis their our racial ethnic identity makes the situation different for those of us who are European American. And it is a lifelong commitment to always work on that.
In last week's Time magazine, I don't know if any of you saw that, it says, Who is America? Or America, Who Are We? It was excellent on who is America. It isn't anymore the European group. I mean, there are so many other people here. And America is confused about who we are.
And yet that very same reality is causing a kind of retrenchment
yes.
in some communities,
right.
which is just
right.
exacerbating
the racial tensions that we feel. If I may, we just have a few minutes before we close. I think that this is a tough problem, and it's one that we have to keep working on, but it's also one of the most important things that we can be doing and one of the most gratifying things that we can be doing. So it's a lot of fun. There are, as well as hard work, there are resources out there, and this is one that I would like to hold up for you, not only for itself, but because it has a lengthy bibliography of children's books in the back, as well as national and local organizations which are working on non-sexist child raising and education. It also includes a couple of things which I was hoping to talk a little bit about, which we don't have time for. It has a couple of pieces that were developed by the Council on Interracial Books for Children, an organization in New York, which has two tools for evaluating the literature you're reading to the children, the kind of posters and pictures you have on your wall, the kind of curriculum you're developing. And one of them is a stereotypes worksheet, which just lists some of the common stereotypes for different racial ethnic groups and for men and women. And some of them are things that we, you know, don't even think about. And we ourselves, you know, buy into these stereotypes unconsciously. So it's very helpful to go back to a tool like this periodically to remind ourselves of some of the things that can be hurtful to people, to children in their development. And the other one is 10 Quick Ways to Analyze Children's Books for Sexism and Racism, which is also very, very helpful in doing that. There are a couple, throughout this book, there are sections which give ideas, and I want to give you some four examples. When you're talking with children about racial ethnic differences, make a book called We All Look Special, with pictures of all different children in the child's experience, either in their classroom, and in their neighborhood, or whatever. But make a book with all the different children in it, and then look at the differences. If you're in a situation where it's an all-white community, I mean, all white people certainly look very different from one another, and you can focus on differences among the children and among the people in the child's life. Whether you're in an all-white community or whether you're in a racially ethnically diverse community, and recognize those differences, but then also talk about all the ways in which we are the same. And that sameness is the piece that pulls us together, but the differences are those special pieces which enhance the relationships we have with one another. One idea the teacher had was to go to a paint store and get paint chips, and then invite the children to find the paint chip which most closely resembled their skin tone, their eye color, and their hair color, and just see what kind of things you come up with. When you're working with young children, have paints, crayons, paper, etc., which is realistic in representing the hair and skin tones of the children in the group. When you're doing your art projects, have art projects which use browns and blacks, beiges and yellows, and really focus on how browns and blacks are beautiful colors. Use them in your Play-Doh, use them in your paint, use them in your paper, use them in all the experiences that you have, as well as other colors. But I think some of us, because of our culture, steer away from using browns and blacks in Play-Doh, in paint, in paper. We need to affirm those colors as good and beautiful in our interactions with young children. When children are slightly older, there's some wonderful things you can do in terms of looking at the eye colors, for example, of children in your group, or then make charts, make graphs. You know, 6 children have blue eyes, 8 children have brown eyes, 2 children have hazel eyes. But you can begin to develop your math and other kinds of experiences around the children, and each one is affirming. Or you could make matching games with swatches of hair. One teacher took a little bit of hair from each child and then had a kind of matching game, you know, whose hair goes with which person. And each person is affirmed but at the same time, the differences are recognized. And there's simple kinds of things, very basic kinds of things, that you can do with young children which affirm the differences and yet recognize each one as being important and to itself.